Does that sound viable, over?
Very viable. And now by using a known gauge of wire and known resistivity of wire made by a quality manufacturer, and you measure the right length of it with your ruler, and now you make a shunt out of that. Let's assume now that I've got a Dawson valve meter movement, the kind that's got a swinging needle, and the basic meter movement inside is a 50 microampere meter. I don't want to measure 50 microamperes. I want to measure 50 amperes. So I'm going to put a shunt across the meter. And that shunt is going to be some number of milliohms in order to adjust the scale, so to speak. So I'm going to put this shunt resistor, a very small number of ohms, carefully laid out across the two leads on the back of that meter. And now my 50 microamp meter, in my example, could become a 50 ampere meter, as long as I know two things. One, I got to know how many microamperes is the meter movement. That's one of three things I got to know. Number two, I got to know how many milliamperes, how many milliohms is my shunt. And number three, I have to know how many ohms is the meter movement itself. And that's a whole measurement. The 50 microampere meter may have an internal resistance of, let me pick a number, 200 ohms. And if I'm trying to make this thing very accurate, I have to know that 200 ohms because it's the third element in my circuit once I lay it out with the right kind of a schematic diagram. And how do you measure the 200 ohms of the meter movement? At first you would say, okay, I just simply put my ohm meter across the meter, my volt-ohm milliammeter. You can't do that. When you're on the lowest ohm scale of the ohm meter, where it's capable of measuring from 0 to 1,000 ohms, that...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That ohm meter, that volt-ohm milliammeter, Simpson or a triplet, and the lowest ohm scale, I don't know the exact number, but maybe it's putting 50 or 100 milliamperes of current through your unknown circuit as a method of measuring its number of ohms. You put 50 milliamperes of current through a meter movement that has a full-scale deflection of 50 microamperes, you have overloaded that meter movement by 1,000 to 1. You try doing that, and the meter movement will go slamming against that upper pin, and it's probably going to be damaged. You can't do that. And so there's a whole art and science to how do you confirm that the meter movement is 200 ohms of resistance in order for you to be able to make this accurate shunt. I won't go through that right now, but make sure you don't make that mistake of putting the lowest ohm scale across a delicate transistor or across a delicate meter movement. In either case, if you're not smart, you can do damage. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, very, very good. Yeah, you're right. Because now we can use P equals I squared R. So that if we know that 3 inches of number 16 gauge wire is 0.001, and we multiply that by 50, that is by the current, which we're looking at, 50 amps, so 50 squared. So we got, let's see, 0.001 times 50 squared, or, hey, 2.5 watts will, 3 inches 16 gauge wire will dissipate 2.5 watts, Vic, over.
KC2, QAQ. In which case that 16 gauge wire might have to be heat sunk, or you might have to put a number of those in parallel to be able to create, to take the power dissipation. A 3-inch length of 16-gauge wire, could it dissipate 2.5 watts without glowing red and without creating damage or burning somebody's fingers? You have to worry about some of those details. Let's see how Glenn solves this problem. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
I was just going to make a comment about copper shunts. That copper has been used, you know, in many, many applications for, you know, for giving you a precision current measurement. But the unfortunate problem with current shunts is their linearity is poor, mainly because you can know the exact resistance of copper at a fixed temperature. So let's say if you were going to calibrate a copper shunt to 100 amps and then you were going to measure millivolts across a certain section, length section of the of that copper to give you a specific reading, a calibrated reading. The problem is when you go to half that current, the problem is that what's happening is you have an I square R kind of problem where the power is dropping, the temperature of the copper is dropping, and the linearity unfortunately at half that that current rating is no longer going to have the linear accuracy. There's going to be a step function because of the temperature drop on copper. Today, because of the availability of metal film resistors, you can get them in such ridiculously low ohms. I would actually suggest, you know, using something like a metal film resistor with a set of Kelvin leads going over to a known meter and then calibrate it that way. Because I think overall, if you want to have a meter that's going to give you good linearity over a wide current range, the copper really isn't going to do it for you. But if you just need to measure within maybe, say, 20% of a specific loading, it's probably just fine, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
If I understand correctly, then, Glenn, what you're saying is that in Mel's example of 1 milliohm and 50 amperes, in my particular device, it's a very large thing on my hand. The thing must be 4 inches long, an inch wide, and almost an inch high. It's the whole package. And inside there's a very wide piece of copper. And when it's dissipating 2.5 watts with this great big chunk of copper on each end, it's a block of solid brass or copper on each end, which has got 2 big bolts on it where you make the high current connection. There's a lot of heat sinking going on here. So that internal piece of 1 milliohm copper is not going to get very much temperature rise, and even though copper has got a fairly high coefficient of resistance versus temperature, and therefore if it gets hot can give you an inaccuracy, the thing in my hand is going to remain reasonably cold, therefore I'm going to get reasonable accuracy out of it. If I go over to a metal film resistor, a 1 milliohm metal film resistor, and I don't know if they go that low, what is
1 microohm?
Okay. And I was about to ask you, when it dissipates 2.5 watts, it's going to get hot, and I think it's going to drift. But if I can go to a microohm, where instead of getting 2.5 watts of dissipation, I'm getting 2.5 milliwatts of dissipation, now my current sensing resistor is going to run so cold that now I don't have any temperature coefficient problems. A metal film resistors, are they known to be pretty good on temperature coefficient, Doug Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you can look up on the data sheets. If you look them up, you can certainly get them into 0.1% initial accuracy. And then if you look at the changes in parts per million, you can select a resistor that will give you very, very, very good temperature response. And it's just saying that, you know, I've tried building copper shunts, but they're excellent for full-scale readings. In other words, if you need something that's calibrated to 100 amps, and you're going to be measuring currents between 70 to 100 amps or 120 or some swing around 100 amps, it's going to be very, very accurate. The problem is when you go to use that same device at like 20 amperes, you'll see that the shift is going to be annoying. It's going to be more than like a 5% shift, where when you start using resistors, metal film, with very, very high accuracy in parts per million, you can actually look at the change in resistance over temperature, and it's really, really small compared to copper. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
The one slight problem when I'm using a 1 microohm sensing resistor is now each ampere only gives me 1 microvolt of drop. So I better have some pretty quiet operational amplifiers to amplify that voltage pickup on the Kelvin connection, lead number 3 and lead number 4, in order to accurately measure that voltage, in order to accurately assess what current is flowing. And if I'm trying to accurately measure a DC voltage of 1 microvolt, I better choose a reasonably high quality op-amp to do that. What do you think, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, you know, here again, it's a matter of sizing your shunt to measure the currents that you're trying to read. Certainly, you have to look at your instrumentation and decide how much voltage that you need to create an accurate measurement in that area. But you can actually get a very, very broad range of very, very high accuracy current measurement with metal film resistors. And as I said, you can calibrate it out so that basically it'll stay and it will work over a very, very wide range of temperature. And so unfortunately with copper, if you just don't really get that kind of accuracy, that is, you know, because as I said, there is that problem. If you take a metal film resistor and you look at it at its, you know, at its full power rating, which you really should never run a resistor anyway, you know, should always derate it at least by a minimum of 70% of its full output, even at room temperature. You know, but here again, you know, you have to size the resistor and, you know, pick a resistance that's going to give you a good reading, but you're going to have 100% better results with metal film as opposed to copper. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Now, before I give this back to Mel, let me bring something clear to you guys, what you're hearing here right now tonight. Glenn lives in an industrial environment where he's making rather precision pieces of instrumentation, and he's looking for high accuracy in order to keep his customer happy, in order to keep his boss happy, in order to have a reliable circuit that he can go into production, he can build 1,000 of them per month, and they all give him predictable results. That's the environment that Glenn lives in. The environment that Dick and Mel live in, half the time, particularly in their home, is the ham radio environment, where Mel told you you could take a piece of 16-gauge wire, and each 3 inches of it is going to give you a milliohm. And where Glenn is telling you the truth, that as that piece of wire gets hot, it's going to give you a few percent, maybe 3%, 4%, 5% of error, because as it gets hot, its resistance changes. Copper has got a temperature coefficient of resistance. And for ham radio operations, good enough is good enough. For most of what we do, if there's a 10% error in our measurement, and we're only getting 90% accuracy, and you're trying to find out, is the antenna a short circuit, an open circuit, or is it working today? Is there a whole lot of snow or ice on the antenna? And I make a standing wave ratio measurement, and I've only got 90% accuracy, and there's 10% error. 98% of the time, for a ham radio operation in your shack, that's good enough. If you suddenly go over to the commercial world, you got to think differently. But the stuff that you own, where you don't want to spend a whole lot of money and a whole lot of time trying to get that last 1% and 0.1% accuracy, sometimes you don't have to worry about these details. It's nice to know they're there. Don't let that stop you. Go ahead and do it. I bet you've gone through that philosophy a number of times in your life, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Most definitely. Of course, a lot of things that we've had out in the actual world when I was working, of course it had to be a situation where, you know, you're dealing with, you know, especially you have to, you know, people don't realize. Basically, there's a lot of things to go through when you go into a production of a piece of equipment. And you have to deal with a number of vendors and different companies and all. So everything has got to be handled a lot different than amateur radio. So that, Glenn, yes, you're 100% right on a commercial level. But if a ham wanted just to measure this kind of, make a current measurement like this, he doesn't have to go out and spend a heck of a lot of money for a fancy shunt such as Dick is holding in his hand. God knows how much the thing was new. You may find them at Hamventions for a reasonable price, things like that, which I have found things that were in the hundreds. Some in the thousands of dollars. I picked them up for a few dollars, such as I can remember, the, like, directional couplers and things of that sort. It's just hybrids and all. They were fortunes when they were made. But for amateur radio use, it's excellent. So making it out of a piece of wire, a shunt, knowing that 0.001 ohms per 3 inches of copper wire, I think is sufficient, Dick. Over.
I agree with you. When it comes to things that we've picked up that are really valuable, one of the things that I pick up for $2, I'll bet you it cost $5,000 originally. It's a simple piece of waveguide. WR90 waveguide. It means it's 9/10 of an inch wide, 0.45 inch high are the internal dimensions of the waveguide. And the whole device is about 10 or 12 inches long. And if you look down the throat of this device, you see a whole bunch of very fancy holes along the side of the waveguide. And there's another piece of parallel waveguide, broad wall to broad wall, with an output connector. What the thing is a 20 decibel co-directional coupler. So it's a directional coupler in waveguide. It tells you how much signal is flowing forward, and it ignores the signal flowing backwards. And the signal that flows forward, it samples it 1%, 20 decibels down. A good directional coupler nowadays has a directivity. In other words, it favors the forward direction versus the reverse direction by, let's say, about 18 dB. That's a good directional coupler. An excellent directional coupler, where you pay quite a bit of money for it, might have 25 or 30 decibels of directivity. An instrumentation-grade directional coupler that might be used by the Bureau of Standards has 40 or 45 dB of directivity. This particular directional coupler, I've carefully measured it, it has more than 50 decibels of directivity. The thing is so directionally sensitive that I can use it as a CW radar. I can put a signal generator in one end, a feed horn on the other end, aim it around the room, look at the directional coupled port into a spectrum analyzer, and I'm looking at a radar as if I'm looking at the equivalent of the reflections of all the things in front of that horn in the room displayed on that spectrum analyzer, as if it was a pulsing device, but there's no pulsing going on. The outgoing signal, the incoming signal, are continuous.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The outgoing signal and the incoming signal are continuously there by the high directivity of the coupler. They're being kept thoroughly separate from each other. And I'm looking independently at the reflections of the room, independent of the transmitter power that's going out into the room. The thing is insensitive to the transmit power, and it's only looking at reflection. Beautiful device, made by Alfred Singer. And they must have spent $5,000 for it. And I picked it up at a flea market in New Hampshire for $2. And there happened to be two of them, and I was smart enough to buy both of them. And when I showed them to the various guys I worked with from time to time, I say, what do you think they're looking at? And they come up with all kinds of answers. Very well-designed device. It was made in the late 60s, early 70s, before you had computer modeling programs, before you had good vector network analyzers, before you had the kind of instrumentation that could measure, design, and confirm this. Some little old microwave engineer who, for all I know, his name was Harold Wheeler. Harold Wheeler, when you talk to him in his lifetime, he believed he knew how that wave, that microwave felt when it went down that guy. He had that kind of gut feeling, understanding for the way waveguide and microwave circuits really work. Some guy with that kind of smarts and intelligence and the drive and the enthusiasm designed this damn thing. It's got some very fancy bends and tapered holes and all kinds of things. And it not only has that way beyond instrument grade accuracy directivity, it does it from 8.5 to 12.5 gigs inclusive. What a machine. So if you know what you're looking at, there are some huge bargains you can have from time to time. K2KEY, K2RW, go ahead, Mel.
Well, definitely. A lot of stuff, like you say, people don't realize it. The best buying I ever had was a couple of years ago on the beach, a chunk of radar equipment, the whole antenna system with the electronics that sits below it, washed up on the beach, just laying there. And I saw it, I didn't believe what I seen. I dragged it off the beach, and oh, did I get some fancy. It was a modern piece of equipment that most likely something happened to the ship, storm or whatever, went overboard and wound up on the beach, and amazed that how many people walked by it and just thought it was like a piece of junk laying there. So, yeah, listen, these things happen. All right, it's 10:30 almost, Dick, so I think we better go on, and we'll pick up on this next week. This is K2KEY.
Okay. We did have a little bit of a conflict here. Joe, W2RYY, did sign in earlier before Rich did. Joe, you had a question for us, and I think you said you were mobile at the time. Maybe you're not mobile now. W2RYY, K2RYW, go ahead, Joe.
Now, I'm at a fixed location in my home QTH. I had a question, I don't know, because I was late signing in today, I was doing other things, and I just had a question. Can that be entered here?
You're number one on the runway. Go right ahead, Joe.
Well, a simple question. Maybe it's complicated, maybe it's simple, I don't know. And it had to do with voltaic cells, I believe, is what these solar cells are made out of. They kind of generate electricity out of light. Do these things wear out? Because the question is I was talking to a friend of mine about this, and he raised a question. I said, I don't know the answer. If you buy one of these systems, it costs you lots and lots of money to put one of these things up. You get so much money back in rebates, but it still costs a lot of money out of your pocket. It takes so many years to recoup your investment, maybe 10 years, maybe more. I don't know. The question he asked me was, and I didn't know this question was, do these things wear out after a length of time? If you run these things for...
Joe, you very mysteriously dropped out, as you said, if you run these things for... did you have a battery drop out or something? Back to you, Joe.
Stand by a minute. Yeah, I'm on high power. That's why I dropped out of my radio. Stand by. There we go. Okay, now I'm in low power. I'm not going to eat up. I just changed batteries also. What did you miss? Let me just repeat the whole question again. I was talking to a friend of mine. We had a conversation about these type of cells, putting up solar cells, and of course, so much money to... you know, put these things up, and it takes so many years to get your investment back out of the system, okay, even after the rebates and everything else that comes with it. His question was, and I didn't know the answer to this, but I'm over here asking it, do solar cells or these photovoltaic cells eventually get to a point where they don't produce the same amount of electricity per amount of light? I don't know what the term or ratio, what you're talking about here, but do they eventually decay and not produce the same amount of electricity per light as they did when they originally knew? Like, say, after 20 years, 25 years, 30 years. Do you know anything about that? Back to you, Dick.
What little I know about that, Joe, the answer is both yes and no. You take the extremely high-efficiency, multi-layer cells, photovoltaic cells that are used for running satellites and things like that by NASA in space. The ultraviolet exposure and all the other kinds of things that are pouring out of that sun do create degradation where, I don't know the exact number, but maybe a 100% efficient photovoltaic cell on day one, 3 years later, is only giving you 80% or 85% of the power output. It's numbers like that. They have invented various coatings they put on those space qualified cells, cutting down the amount of ultraviolet that hits the cells, and the amount of degradation is drastically decreased. In the case of photovoltaic cells that you and I use on planet Earth, where the atmosphere most of the time does a pretty good job of filtering out the ultraviolet, the amount of degradation you get is there, but I think it's small. And if you ask the right question of... the manufacturer of your photovoltaic cells, he should be able to tell you the aging characteristics under normal circumstances. Photovoltaic cells that you put on your house to have standby power or a power assist, let's call it, I think the majority of what you've got to worry about are mechanical problems. The thawing and melting of ice in the wintertime, creating mechanical disconnects and whatever, things hitting them and whatever. I'd worry about that a little bit more. Yes, they're all going to have a little bit of degradation, but if they were a good design, the manufacturer should be able to tell you how much, and I think it's a number you can live with. And I think 5 years downrange, you're still going to be getting 90% of the power out of them if they're properly treated. So it's a question to ask, but it's not a showstopper, is my understanding. I'm going to pass it back to Joe, but Joe's going to drag his feet a little bit in case we have other photovoltaic experts in the tri-state area that want to give us the benefit of their knowledge, because part of what I just said is what I've read, what I've remembered, and I may not have the full story. WA2RYY with some delay, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized, anyone else? You got it, Glenn. I think you use photovoltaics in your business, so what have you seen with reference to aging and degradation? You got it, Glenn.
Yeah, unfortunately there isn't a lot of documented information on this so far, and I'm not sure why it is. I've been requesting it, but I can tell you what I've observed myself, that I've actually am asking these manufacturers to make improvements on, because I've found two failure mechanisms so far. The first one that causes aging is a lensing effect. In other words, they get cloudy. You know, the surface on the top, you're going to get maximum efficiency when basically the clear surface on the top is clear. If it starts dulling, you're going to lose some efficiency there. Let me let it drop for a second. second mode of failure that I've been finding with these things are basically it's a transistor failure. They have a tendency of shorting out. If you take like a typical 48-volt cell, at full power, they can put out almost like 72 volts. After a certain period of time, somewhere like around five to 10 year mark, they start rolling off. You're not going to get 72 volts out of them anymore. They'll still put out the current, but the voltage starts dropping down. And I think the problem that you run into is that over a period of time where they start dropping below 48 volts, where enough transistors have failed inside them, it's probably about a 10-year life cycle. I think that, you know, they don't really have these things worked out for long term. And the key failures where the transistors die is hot temperature in the summer, if they're getting too hot. And the other problem, because remember, they're not heat sunk devices. And the other problem is when they get too cold. Sometimes I think they get fractures internally. And those are the ones that I've taken apart and looked inside to see what kind of failures. So I've seen the cold, temperature fractures, and the other one being the high temperature, shorts. So I would say that the total life out of the ones that exist today is probably somewhere around 10 years, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Glenn, you used the word transistor. The actual photovoltaic is a diode. And yes, of the voltage that those photovoltaic diodes, a bunch of them are in series, get for you, it might be 48 volts or greater, that does go into a transistorized inverting network that brings that 48 volts, say, of DC up to a higher voltage, like 120 volts of AC. And that's a inverting circuit. And now once you've got the right phase and amplitude of voltage, you can not only run the circuits in your house, but you can pump it back to Con Ed or Lilco. So transistors are used in the inverter, but I'm a little bit worried now about the actual photovoltaic receiving panels. You use the word transistors on those. I wonder if those are really diodes. Bring me up to speed on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the most accurate sense of the word, they are diodes. But they are referred to as photosensitive transistors. I mean, that's kind of like the loosely confederated term for them, as I've seen used on the market on a lot of these. But you're right. I think in general structure they are closer to a diode. But they do break down. And the failure to high temperature, and when they're sitting up on the roof, and they get a lot of high temperature heat over years, they do short out. And one of the other things that I've done is to, and I've advised people, and I see some of the installers now are starting to get smarter, is to break the, in other words, instead of paralleling everything into one main inverter, is to break them off into strings and use multiple inverters on the other side. Because if you start getting a group of your cells shorting out, you may not see it as quickly when they're all tied all together and you're just not getting power. Where, if you have indicators on the specific inverters where you can see the charging voltages on individual strings, you'll see it much quicker. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
That sounds very smart that you break it up into modules, and now you've got a kind of redundancy and independent failure, as opposed to if they were all in one great big parallel group and one of them became a short circuit, and the other five port all their power into that short circuit, it accelerates the damage and also stops the whole thing from working. Pretty smart. Where the lens above the photovoltaic becomes fogged, there are certain kinds of plastic under ultraviolet exposure, the glass itself, the plexiglass or Lexan or polycarbonate or whatever will fog. So the higher quality ones are probably made out of kinds of materials that are UV protected, and if the coating out front was really glass, I'd like to believe the fogging problem wouldn't happen, but now they're more expensive cells. Is that approximately what we're talking about here, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, I believe so, Dick. I think overall, if you see plastic layers up on the top, I wouldn't even touch one of those. The glass will even get clouded. It's amazing how just the elements, birds doing their thing on them, and snow, and just general air conditions, wind conditions. I think it's also important if somebody's going to make that big of an investment is to climb up there every so often and go make sure you're up there with some Windex and keep them clean. That would probably help that problem quite a bit. That's some of the things I've done. But it's amazing how after a period of time that they do get, the surface does get very, very rough and kind of beat up, where probably at least once a year, to go up there with some Windex and really clean them off is not a bad idea. It's also another thing for installers to remember to put some kind of like spacing between the panels, so it gives you a little work area to walk in between, so that if you do need to go up there and clean them at least once a year, like, you know, typically somebody might do to power wash the side of their house to keep their siding clean, might be a good idea to go up there and clean off those panels too. So a little bit of Windex and, you know, shine them up. Make sure you're getting your full investment out of them, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, KEY with comments.
Yeah, I'm going to go over to Glenn in a minute. Let me go back to, Mel in a minute. Glenn, I'm getting the sound, I'm hearing the sound that you own photovoltaics. I'm kind of curious as to how many watts do you generate? How many square meters do you have? How many years have you been doing it? Over to you, Glenn.
I'm not powering my house, Dick. This is an experiment that I've been running here at my house for a little bit better than 5 years, and it's basically to power the ham radio equipment. I'm doing it with batteries, and I've got inverters that I built myself, and I've been running it and just trying to see what kind of lifetime expectancy I can get out of batteries. Originally, I thought the batteries were basically going to go first. But as it turns out, that my charging circuits work much better than I thought, and I keep the batteries because I don't have too many. I'm using 12-volt cells, and I'm using a bank of 24. I think it's 12 batteries in between series parallel. Cause I have to make up my 48-volt system, and I've got a charging circuit on there that's always keeping the batteries charged accurately, and they're kept in a pretty good temperature. So the batteries have lasted pretty well. The inverters I've had no problem with whatsoever. But the cells are delicate, in my opinion, at least so far. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done there. I think to get 5 years of life out of them, I think it's not going to be a problem. But I think when you start trying to go towards 10 years, there's going to be some failures in them. I mean, I've seen them. And my whole system for charging, batteries for amateur radios, typical output of about a kilowatt, Dick, maximum.
You just said some magic words, Glenn. 5 years, and you're a kind of guy that would buy, you would do quite a bit of searching before you lay down your money and buy a particular brand name of photovoltaics, and you bought, I'm going to guess, medium good brand, not Cadillac, but not Hugo. You bought something in between. You bought Buick brand photovoltaics, and you would trust them for 5 years, but 10 years you would worry at the rate of failures you have seen of the photovoltaics themselves. And many a person has said, okay, I have to invest this number of dollars, it's going to generate that number of watts, what's my return on investment, when's my payback? And quite often the answer is the payback is 10, 12, 14, 16 years. And if the photovoltaics have only medium reliability for 10 years, that makes the calculation a lot more difficult and a lot more pessimistic. See what Mel's going to say on all this. K2KEY, how much photovoltaics have you used, Mel? K2RIW in the TechNet?
K2L.
Bernie recognized, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, says K2KEY. You know, that's why they are not popular around here, and I'll tell you why. A number of us around here had our windows have this lensing effect on the windows of the house. We've replaced windows here, and especially the ones that face here south and the ones that face here to the west get sandblasted, and that's from the beach sand. When the wind blows, there's a certain amount of that beach sand that sandblasts this area. And after what Glenn just said, I think that the life expectancy of a photovoltaic system here would even be reduced, because I think that that fine dust that comes off the beach here, the fine sand that blows sometimes, with a lot of wind velocity behind it, would do damage to those photovoltaics in a fairly short time, maybe and they wouldn't go to 10 years under any effect, be efficient, Dick, over.
Yeah, let me ask for a double check on this one, Mel. The windows on the south and the west on your house that you had to replace because they were sandblasted and they started looking fogged, was that real Corning glass that you had to replace? Was the glass itself being blasted by your environment? That combined with the salt spray, wow, you got a wicked environment, which must also be eating up the paint on the side of your house. How about you, Mel?
We put the windows in, you know. We left them. I mean, it's a yard sandblast. Definitely, they have some lensing. You know, you can wash them and use anything you want on them. You can't get them to look, you know, as good as some of the other windows in the house facing the north. Or it's acceptable, of course. But the effect here from the salt air and the wind coming off the ocean. If you have siding, I've seen here some of the houses that have aluminum siding, gets extremely pitted. You should see wrought iron railings if they're not every year painted, or every other year given a good cleaning up and painted. You want to see. I can show you. You'd stand there and I'll show you railings that you can pick the railings apart with your nail on your fingernail, Dick. The deterioration from the salt. It eats up. You see cars here that a car is like 10 years old. A neighbor of mine, he has little or no mileage on the car, and it's about 10 years old. The bumper is eaten away completely, Dick. Metal bumper. Completely gone, almost. Over.
Wow. You've got to be a rugged guy because you're living in a rough environment there, Mel, as I see it. Bernie, don't give up on that rig. You got a beautiful sounding rig, just that the microphone and maybe the audio circuit needs a little bit of help. So speak up a little bit closer to that mic, talk a little bit louder, and give us some of your nice tones. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, I haven't completely given up yet. This poor thing has a hum when I use high power, and it's got low audio, but it went swimming last fall when my car died, so it lost some of its hump when it went underwater. I was just going to give you some feedback on payback times. A good friend of mine put a system in last year, 2010, was his first calendar year with the system fully online, and he's projecting a payback in 5 years. Now, part of what allows this to happen is that we pay such a horrendous electrical rate here. If we were in New Mexico or Arizona, it would be probably 10 or 15 years to pay back because they pay substantially less per kilowatt than we do. But just to give you some windage, he did get some government money that paid a substantial part. I don't know if it was federal, state, or where, but he did get some assistance because he was putting in green energy production. But, yeah, his current payback projection is 5 years. I was helping him write some software to plot his usage and be able to visualize his usage, and it's interesting to see. I was looking at his data from yesterday that basically about 9 o'clock in the morning when the sun got high enough in the sky, his consumption from LIPA went down to zero, and then I actually saw him actually generating backwards. At some point he was generating about 2 kilowatts back to LIPA in the primary part of the day. So it's very interesting to see. He said last year his final outcome was that he did not buy any electricity from LIPA. He had to pay access charges and line charges, but he did not actually buy any electricity.
KC2QAQ with comments.
Glenn recognized, but let me go back to Bernie for a minute here. Bernie lives in Garden City, which I think is the heart of Nassau County. And I'm getting the impression that Nassau has some nice rebate options and 5 years of payback and a meter that reads backwards and whatever and a good relationship with LIPA. To your knowledge, Bernie, do the people in Brooklyn where Mel lives have anywhere near as desirable a sounding environment for renewable energy techniques? I'm getting the impression from what everything Mel has told me that the amount of rebate and the amount of extra taxes, in other words, his property tax goes up because he's got photovoltaics. There's a bunch of anti-incentive for at least certain portions of Brooklyn. So from your knowledge and your exposure to this, Bernie, is Nassau a lot more smart on this than, say, Brooklyn or Queens? K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 RIW.
I don't have any direct data to be able to draw this on, but I do have 10 years of experience with dealing with Con Ed and city electrical codes, and the answer is no. They are very restrictive. For example, here in Nassau and Suffolk, we use the NEC code. In the city, they use their own code. It's not NEC. It's different. And so, no, the city does not seem to be anywhere near as friendly. The NEC, like the National Electric Code, is very friendly towards doing this, but I perceive the city not to be.
Whenever I watch Channel 25-2 these days, a zillion hours per day, I see Mayor Mike Bloomberg reestablishing this business and opening up this museum and opening up that art gallery and doing this to improve the environment and doing this to improve the education and whatever. All kinds of changes every day, hour after hour. He's showing you all these improvements he's making. How in the world has a guy with that much smarts and that much wherewithal not realize that energy consumption and renewable energy and proper incentives are really required? How come he hasn't hit on that one yet? Got an opinion on that one, Bernie?
He's a Republican.
And then I'm going to go over, I know, and then I'm going to go over to Glenn. Bernie first, K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW.
Well, first to correct Richie's comment, he's not a Republican anymore. He's not a registered Republican. The point is that I think that Mayor Mike does want the city to go green. The problem is that look at the challenge he's having trying to move the school board. He's got to get the building department to change regulations. If you've ever tried to file permits in the city, it's practically an act of God is required. So I think Mike is spending his political capital where he can, and doing this kind of stuff is. It's going to take a while for the building department to catch up.
And I see one other problem, and that is only the techies do this. There's one ham radio operator per 500 in the general population. The number of human beings in the general population who are progressive enough that they want to have almost energy independence or they want to have renewable energy resources on their property and pump energy back to Con Ed and Lilco, that's a rare human being. And since the number of people, the percentage of the population, as low as it is, it's more difficult for him to justify putting great resources into that. That's a guess on my part. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2RIW. You got it, Glenn.
I just wanted to add a couple of words, Dick, about the, you know, this lensing effect still that Mel is talking about. You know, it's not just limited to the seashore where this is a problem. I mean, you can see it just about anywhere because the just the general environment overall. I mean, if you look at glass in a car and, you know, just restoring cars after, you know, say 10 years, you want to restore a Corvette or your favorite car, one of the nicest ways of really brightening up the car and making it look better is changing the glass. It just makes everything so much more clear, nice and shiny. It looks so much better. You take the glass in a 10-year-old car that's even been garaged, and, you know, generally the glass just isn't as nice. And you can imagine what happens to a solar voltaic cell sitting up on your roof, pointing straight up, practically. I mean, they're at slight angles, but, you know, they're definitely taking abuse from the elements, for sure. Let me let it drop for a second.
Yeah, and a quick break. Can I buy something in an automobile aftermarket, some kind of a juice that I can coat on the outside of the windshield of my car and make some improvement in those pit marks? Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I mean, there's even a very common thing, Rain-X is great stuff. But here again, it's another film you're adding up on top. The whole idea behind the solar voltaic is you really want to get the solar energy through that film as best as you can, not add more. I mean, I think that's more of an aesthetic type of a thing that helps the vision of a driver, where, you know, you're not really getting a true impairment through your vision through the windshield. But let's say when you're talking about a solar voltaic, you know, where you need the solar energy to get through there, it really is an impairment. And I'm not sure that something like Rain-X is really going to help all that much, Dick.
KBTYQN with a comment.
YQN recognized. Get to you in a second. When it comes to Rain-X on photovoltaic cells, I can see how it's not going to do much. If Rain-X can remove some of the pit marks from my windshield, that is worth doing. Because at nighttime, when I'm driving to the west and the sun is shining directly into my eyes, and that windshield and its pit marks are lighting up, I'm looking through a continuous fog when I look at that road in front of me. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it definitely is hurting the signal-to-noise ratio of what I get on that forward road. Even though I've got the sun visor down, I'm not looking at the sun directly, but that windshield is lit up with direct sunlight. YQN, give me your full call letters and your name, and proceed with your comment, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
I have a comment, Dick.
Don recognized. YQN, go ahead.
It's Chris, KB2YQN. I just wanted to mention that you keep in mind that glass is not a solid, it's a supercooled liquid. So as it gets hot, it tends to flow just slightly. So that's one of the reasons that 10-year-old glass tends to have waviness in it.
In the case of safety glass, where you've got a mylar-like material between two layers, and that mylar can change its characteristics versus time, I'm going to agree with you. But in the case of glass, which, yes, it's an amorphous material, yes, it doesn't have a melting temperature, it has a melting range, it is always a fluid. But at normal room temperatures, normal glass is flowing at a rate that is so slow that I'm having trouble with that one. There are lots of people who used to make measurements of the windows glass that was on ancient buildings, you know, buildings that were built in 1600, 1500. And the theory was that the bottom of the glass is thicker than the top of the glass because it has been flowing for 300 years. Well, they soon found out the way they manufactured the glass and the way they installed it was creating that difference. The glass wasn't flowing that fast. It was a false impression. So are you getting extra waviness from the windshield because the glass is flowing? I'm having a problem with that. If the car was 1,000 years old, I agree with you. But a 10-year-old car, I don't think the glass can flow fast enough. But that's an opinion. I ain't so sure. John, KC2WGB, K2RAW, go ahead, John.
Dick, you can bring that luster back on a windshield with jeweler's rouge, the same thing they use to do your watch crystals. Magnificent work, and it does a good job. But the people out west, in the southwest, live with replacing windshields every 2 years, every year and a half, because of the sandblast. And the paint comes off the front of the car also. Ask anybody out there. I'm sure Gwen's aware of that, too. But just to let you know, if you have a spot that gives you trouble in the window, a buffing wheel and jeweler's rouge will take it right out.
It sounds like you've done that, John. If I've got a good drill motor, a good buffing wheel, and that red-orange jeweler's rouge or whatever, and I want to clear up a section directly in front of the driver's eyes, let's assume I want to clear up 1 square foot, so to speak, are we talking about 10 minutes or an hour's worth of work to do that? What do you think, John?
Yes, I have done it, Dick. Less than 10 minutes. But you need one of the large buffing wheels, the horizontal, like a right-angle drill, it looks like, and the large lambskin on it. They make that rouge in two grits. They make a red and I think a gray. If the winch is really bad, you have to use the gray to cut. Same as making lens on the telescope. Very similar.
KC2QIQ.
Glenn recognized. John, when I do that, if I don't do it carefully, do I end up with some slight waviness to the glass? And I am abrading the glass. Depending on how much I take away, don't I eventually create weakening of the safety glass? Over to you, John, first.
Negative. You're cutting such a small amount of glass off of it, because if you microscopically look at those little pits in the glass, that's what's causing a diffraction when you're driving into the sun. And they come out pretty easily. And I think you'd find it pretty easy to do, and it will surprise you. Go ahead, back to you, Dick.
WS2N.
Paul recognized. John, if I wanted to replace the windshield instead of going through this effort, if the windshield was $30, I'd do it immediately. If it's $150, I'm going to be a little bit slower. If it's $300, I ain't going to do it. I should know, but I don't know. Got to guess as to roughly what is the replacement value of a windshield these days that has the built-in antenna. Over to you, John.
Ah, there's the rub. I've never replaced one with the built-in antenna, but they were $240 for a plain one, and another one was $310. I replaced two windshields last year.
Okay, that gives me a ballpark. Glenn, you got it?
I just wanted to make a comment about the, you know, the Jewelers Rouge and, you know, also things like Black Ebony. Jewelers does a very similar kind of job, a little bit more work with, but you kind of get a similar effect. That it does work, but the problem is it doesn't last. In other words, if you have a, you know, a windshield that, if you were fortunate enough not to get a crack in it after 5 years, and it's got that little bit of, like, sandblasting on it, and you go up there and you use that to polish it off, it will last for a while. But what I've noticed is it tends to come back within a year or so. So it's something that it doesn't last as long as the original finish that was on the glass. It's something you kind of have to, you know, do every once in a while to keep on bringing it back. I guess nothing beats fresh glass, if you know what I'm saying, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
K2IL.
I've already recognized, and you're after a poll. There's something called Tiger Glass, I think they call it. In other words, there's ways you can buy glass that is internally tension-stressed in order to make it stronger. By the same token, I'm going to guess that the windshield has a hardened outer surface when it's new. And when you rub through that hardened outer surface, which maybe is only a thousandth of an inch thick, to get rid of the pit marks, you're now getting down to the deeper glass down deep that is not as hardened. I'm going to guess that that's a possible explanation for why it pits more rapidly. Do you think that's possible, Glenn? Go ahead.
There must be something, Dick, in the manufacture of the glass, because it's not just the windshield. It's, you know, it's the side glass, the rear glass. You can use that, and it definitely, I mean, it polishes up the glass nice. I mean, you put it on, you know, on a windshield that's got, you know, as long as the scratches in the windshield aren't, you know, like fingernail deep, It'll literally take them out. But what is interesting is that when it's done, and you use Windex on the glass and everything else, after about a year or so, you find that you kind of have to do it over again. So there is something to the outer surface. Exactly what it is, I'm not sure. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'll bet you if we do more investigation, we'll find out they do make a harder outer surface. Paul, WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to try to find out about a product that my son-in-law used for the lights. You know, he's got like a 10-year-old car, and you look at the headlights, and you look at an older car, they're very, very foggy. I mean, you know, it's a big, big difference. You know, that's down near the road, and it gets hit with more stuff as you drive. Well, he used this product, you know, from Aid Auto. I'll have to find out the name and all. But, wow, he did one of them. I saw, you know, the one that was done and the one that wasn't done, and a huge difference. So I'll have to find out if that works out on a windshield as well. But if it does, I mean, that was real super stuff. But, inexpensive from, you know, like Aid Auto. Dick, back to you.
Well, KC2, QIQ with a comment?
Glenn recognized. Paul, is this stuff some kind of a fluid that you put on a rag and just wipe it onto the headlight, or is there a whole procedure required to get all this great improvement? How was that done, if you happen to know, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, it's a procedure. You need to have like a drill with a pad on it and all, you know. You know, it's not going to be easy, Dick. And a light is very small compared to a whole windshield. So, but I don't know. Maybe they make something similar. I'm going to go investigate. That shouldn't be too hard to find out. I got an Aid store right nearby me. Dick?
Further comments, you think?
WIE?
WIE. It's going to be about four guys before we get to you. Okay, this is a whole thing I've got to investigate. The shifting cable of my Toyota broke, and I epoxied it back together, and I'm trying to find out, do I have to go through a much more elaborate procedure to make that reliable, or is that cable replaceable? And I'm hoping that Chilton's going to tell me that, because nothing online will tell me that. So I got a number of reasons to go to my automobile store and ask these questions. Bernie was the next person on the list. K2IO, go ahead, Bernie.
Dick, I was going to recommend, take a look at your insurance policy on your car. Many insurance policies cover glass replacement with no deductible. And
You know, if you have any cracks or dings in it, you might want to report it to your insurance company and have them just replace it.
Yeah, I'm not the kind of guy that's going to put a crack or a ding into it. And lucky for me, I don't think I've got any. I've got an ethics problem on this one. I know the WIE, but there's somebody who came before him. Who is that person who came before him?
I'm not implying put a crack in your windshield. No, I agree with you. That is an ethics issue. But just keep in mind that if it becomes bad enough, it may be covered.
Oh, I was well aware you were not recommending that I do that, Bernie. Stop worrying. Glenn, go ahead.
And I was in there too, Dick.
Glenn, John, and then WIE in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about plastic and making plastic really, really clear, and it lasts. This is a wonderful thing if you've never done it before. If you've ever had a meter movement or with a plastic front cover on it that gets cloudy or really scratched, or a digital readout, or lenses on the front of a car. This is a trick I found from an old detailer. Crest toothpaste, white, without any abrasive in it. So you put it right on any kind of clouded plastic, and just take a chamois and just start rubbing it in, and you will literally rub out almost any kind of like cloudiness in the plastic, and it brings it back up to like a perfect shine. I mean, you might have to be there a little while to do it, but if you've ever had a little cloudiness or scratches in any kind of plastic, Crest ultra white toothpaste without any grit in it, it works phenomenal, Dick. It's the best way to shine up clear plastic that I've ever seen. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Do you think it contains some kind of very fine pumice? What's your guess, Glenn?
I just want to, I can't give you the answer to the molecular level, but I can tell you it works. Back to you.
Sounds awful good. John, KC2WGB, you got it.
I think I just wanted to point out your side windows and rear windows are a type of Herculite tempered glass. That's different and much harder than the windshield. For some reason, I guess they don't want the front windshields exploding into those little seeds and going all over the car in a collision. But the safety glass might be a little softer than those side glasses. I'm not sure. But I know that the side and the rear are tempered glass Herculite.
Good to know. Mr. W.I.E., give me your full call and your name, sir, and then proceed with your comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
KC2WIE, Eric, in Manhattan. I just had my windshield replaced on my car after struggling, with the issue at hand. I had some minor scratches where I tried jeweler's polish and all kinds of mild abrasives. Number one, I think it's a question of the grade of your windshield. I know Mercedes has two grades of windshields. I have a Honda now, the problem for me wasn't evident until nighttime when you had headlights hitting your windshield, and it was as annoying as can be. I finally threw in the towel after consulting with several auto glass replacement places, and the consensus from these people was that If you try to buff it, you're going to wind up with some type of wavy type of reflection on the windshield. And like I said, during the daylight hours, it wasn't a problem at night. So like I said, I finally threw in the towel. It cost me, I had it done in Pennsylvania. It cost me $259. The guy came, installed, replaced the windshield in my driveway. End of problem.
Yeah, that's good to know, Eric. And thank you for that information. Eric, your audio is quite heavy on that rig. You're ramming up against the sides of this particular repeater. So you might want to cut back that audio a little bit. And I'm not talking about the gain. Yeah, maybe I'm talking about the gain, or maybe I'm talking about the compression level. Somewhere in that rig, the audio was turned up a bit high. So the next time you're at a tune-up clinic, like at a LIMOC function where Andy, the B2CDL, is setting up the